Hey friends, you're listening to the Hope and Hard Pills podcast, where we're talking all things resilience and revolution. I'm Andre.
I'm Trishes.
And today we are joined by a very special guest. We're so happy to have her in the virtual studio. Author, womanist, theologian, scholar, Ebony Janice.
It's me.
Hey, thank you so much for being
Welcome
here.
Welcome to the show. Thank you so much
thank
for being
for
here.
Thank you for having me.
And Ebony Janice is the author of the soon-to-be New York Times bestseller, We're Saying It Now, right? At the time of this recording,
we're manifesting it all together. Yeah,
at the time of this recording, Trish and I don't know if it's a bestseller, but by the time you're hearing this, it probably is. All the Black Girls Are Activists.
Yeah.
Ebony Janice, once again, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you for all the work that y'all do. Y'all are beautiful.
Thank you for the work that you do, including this remarkable book that I'm holding in my hands, All the Black Girls Are Activists. Now, when I first heard the title alone, I was like, okay, there's a lot there. There's a lot going on in this title. And the subtitle, A Fourth Wave Womanist Pursuit of Dreams as Radical Resistance. Could you tell us about where the title and the vision for this book came from?
Yeah, the title, All the Black Girls Are Activists. Okay, so we're only here for a good time, not a long time. So This is a long story. I'm going to make it short. It originally was supposed to be a romance novel.
Really?
This is a true story.
Surprising.
Of the same title?
The same title.
Oh,
and
my God.
And the story, don't steal my book in the event that I at some point decide to write this book. But the story is really about this love, this Black love, that in the midst of 2020, 2021, so much is going on. It was an actual relationship that I was in. That wow. the only drama was the world. It was not our love story. Mm. It was not us.
Wow.
And yes. So there would be times when we were long distance. There would be times when maybe we were going to have a FaceTime date. But then a young Black girl is murdered in Columbus, Ohio by the police. And so
we're
two Black bodied people who love each other, but got to figure out how to deal with our bodies and our spirit and our energy for the day. And so I was thinking about what it would look like to write this beautiful love story where the conflict is not the two of them. The conflict is the world.
Mm.
And how do we still stay in the love and, you know, still stay in the sweetness?
Wow.
But the more that I started to think about it, the more I realized that there was a lot of ethic and theory and practice that needed to be fleshed out. Mm-hmm. And the book was going to turn into this really deep kind of, you know, theological, exegeted, you know, it was this much.
Yeah.
And so I started writing some of the major themes down that would have shown up in this, you know, book if I really were to have written that book, and was like, well, I know that this is another wave of womanism. I need to introduce this first before I, you know, roll it out in this way. So yeah, it was originally, and the title, All the Black Girls Are Activists, really, you know, as I was thinking about it as a romance novel, it was really like, the Black girls just want to be loved like everybody else does. Mm. Shout out to Jill Scott. Mm. And that, you know, was the beginning of it. And then the more I fleshed it out, it's really ultimately just saying, if the Black girls don't do nothing else but show up as our actual selves, that is our contribution to resistance. And that is radical. Wow. And that is activism.
Mm.
Yeah.
For our listeners, could you talk about the word womanist and what is the difference between a feminist and a woman?
Yes. Womanism is a term coined by Alice Walker in her 1983 book, In Search of Our Mother's Garden. And it's really written originally as prose, kind of poetically. You know, it's a four-part definition. The fourth part of the definition says, womanism is to feminism as purple is to lavender. And so Alice Walker ultimately was saying that womanism is Black women's deeper shade of purple. It's Black women's deeper feminist work. Mm. Additionally, Alice Walker, in a lot of the work that she was doing around this time before In Search of Our Mother's Garden came out, she really wanted to acknowledge the fact that also Black women who were identifying as womanist or decided to identify as Black feminist or as womanist specifically, at the very least, we should be able to name ourselves. And so in a lot of ways, it was really a way of saying Black women's feminism is this and not that as it pertains to white feminism, right? And so right. to be able to just to distinguish the difference. And the elder womanist, I don't think necessarily, and Black feminist, I don't think necessarily would really argue whether or not you should use the term womanist or feminist. Maybe mm-hmm. some do, but all don't. But ultimately, the decision that I have taken on this naming of myself, because at the very least, I should be able to name myself. And I also lean further into womanism, because womanism has more of a spiritual, holistic, you know, deeply connected mm-hmm. relationship with what it would look like for us to be able to change the world, you know, than feminism does. Feminism, in fact, needs a womanist revival, but that's a conversation for another day.
Why is it a conversation for another day?
I'm just saying it's a conversation for another day, because
I get a little though?
Okay,
yeah, let's get a little bit of that.
Only if you want to. Like,
yeah, no, I could go there. I think that there. So I have asserted, and thankfully the elder womanist scholars that were part of the first, second, and third wave of that are part of the first, second, and third wave of womanism have affirmed in so many ways, and just very beautiful ways that they agree. This is another wave of womanism that we're in. Yeah. And so, but for feminism, we're ultimately supposedly in either a fourth or a fifth wave of feminism. Right. And if you go along with the waves and you see how the waves have progressed, there has been a lot of very transformative work done. Of mm-hmm. course, we have in the last 4 or 5 years been having more conversations about intersectionality. And so all of these things are important, right? Like, feminism has come a long way since the racist foremothers, you know, mm-hmm. really, mm-hmm. you know, call themselves, you know, suffragettes. Mm-hmm. But there has not been a very intentional work inside of feminism around the spirit, the whole spirit, soul, and body. Mm. So there's been like this wholeness, wellness kind of movement, you know, yes. like the yoga pants girls and that right. call themselves feminists, et cetera. Uh-huh. But like a deep, actual internal healing work that required yeah. for us to actually be able to deal with our ancestors and heal mm-hmm. and, you know, mm-hmm. and for people of color, when we deal with our ancestors and are in relationship with our ancestors, we do that, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But yeah. For many white people specifically, when they talk about ancestors or do that work, they skip over their American, you know, they skip over the years on this continent and they go to Europe or they go to wherever, you know, they have decided that their ancestors are from, and they try to. And so they miss out on actually acknowledging grandmother and grandfather yeah. and right. great grandmother and uncle, and maybe not even that far, maybe mama, yeah. maybe daddy. Right.
Yeah.
And so, but feminism, Black feminist and womanist have deeply been in fleshing what it looks like for us to actually heal ourselves and heal our community, and how those are not even two separate things. To heal myself yes. is to heal my community, right? Yes. And there has not been a contemporary feminist movement that's been invested in that in a way that's not kind of just lukewarm, right? Like yeah. we want to touch on wellness, but we don't want to touch on wholeness. We don't want to touch on what it means for me to, when I talk about being whole, I'm talking about me, my mother, my grandmother, my great grandmother, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And for many white feminists that are even having any kind of conversation about spirituality, they're certainly not, you know, as a collective having that kind of conversation. And Black feminism and womanism specifically is.
I love the, thank you for being so generous, first off, in kind of taking us through the different waves and all of that around feminism. I know there's a lot of confusion in the world, especially right now, like on TikTok, when I just listen to what Black men and Black women are talking about when they talk mm-hmm. about feminism. It's all that. But I also want to make sure that we don't get too far from your book. And one of the chapters, I believe it was a chapter on softness, mm-hmm. You said that your vision of softness was not about landing around white feminism and all of that, mm-hmm. right? And so I wondered what, I can't remember exactly how you said it, but it sounded like that it implied that some people do aspire to some kind of whiteness or white version of that or whatever. Could you say more about your vision of softness, right? And mm-hmm. and what you're juxtaposing it against, like, because there was a reason why it was necessary for you to make that distinction.
Yeah, I will come back to the definition of softness, but I have short attention span, so I want to make sure that I don't forget that part. That when I mentioned that it's not, my definition of softness isn't even thinking about white women in that way, because softness, there's like this movement, the soft girl era, or, you know, like soft life era, like that's the language that a lot of social media has been using for probably the last 6 or so years. And there is an origin to it that comes from two different places. There is, this is really the history of soft girl era. There is a Nigerian tweet that happened years ago.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, this is a history of soft life era.
I love this.
This is a Nigerian tweet that happened years ago where this Nigerian woman who's like living in like the lap of luxury was just kind of expressing what her experience was. And she was like, I don't want to struggle. I want a soft life. And so it just became this thing of like, I want a soft life. So there's that. But additionally, there is separately, has for years been a conversation amongst a lot of Black women, particularly when you think about Dr. Shaniqua Walker Barnes' book, Case for a Strong Black Woman, Burden of a Strong Black Woman. She's talking about the difference between being a strong Black woman, one word, and a Black woman who happens to be strong. And so in that, we have been thinking for years, privately and out loud, about what does it mean then to be a Black woman who happens to be strong? What are the other things that we get to be then as a result? And so softness, when I talk about softness as defined in the book, I'm not talking about the divine feminine, which very often is like this relationship with some white feminine, you know, archetype that is defined by white supremacist realities. And it's not thinking about Black women's bodies at all. So yeah, when I talk about softness, I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about a regulated nervous system. You know, I'm talking about being able to like sit down in my body on a consistent basis, you know, where, and I'm talking about the seat. I call it the seat of Toni because Toni Morrison would be my actual softness archetype. She's, you know, because Toni Morrison could say really big things fully seated, right? Like not from this, you know what it feels like to be in resistance versus what it feels like to be sitting down in your body. And that is not a practice that I think we have had the privilege, particularly Black women, that's not a practice that we've had the privilege to live into. For many of us, it's not a practice that we've even been able to consider because of the armor and the story and the stereotypes that we have had to live in and the tropes that we've had to been forced to live into. And so softness as an ideology is not this, is not this kind of white centered, sweet, laying on a lily pad, you know, kind of idea, even though I want to lay on a lily pad. But that's not the softness that, you know, we're focused on. I believe that this fourth wave of womanism is focused on a softness where we get to stay in our bodies and not have to abandon ourselves to be strong or to be guarded or to be in an armor.
Yeah.
And I know you've described yourself not just as a womanist, but as a hip hop womanist. Mm-hmm. And the way that I've heard you speak about hip hop is as a sacred text. I would love for you to elaborate on why. What does hip hop womanist mean to you?
Yeah, so I came to womanism actually from a theological perspective, even though it is the original language is sociopolitical in a lot of ways. But at some point, Black liberation theology, as the language coined by Dr. James Cone, there are all these studying theology from this Black liberationist perspective. And so there were Black women that were a part of that original cohort that were like, this is wonderful. We see ourselves, but you've not really thought about the fact that Black women's experience is a very unique experience that needs to be fleshed out, that we need to understand that God has seen Black women in a very unique way. And so they took Alice Walker's naming womanist and they began to call themselves womanist theologians. So that is actually how I came to womanism before I even knew that Alice Walker had coined the term womanism. And so because I am an ordained preacher, I've been preaching in the Baptist church from the pulpit since I was 7, 8 years old. That was my entrance into thinking about sacred texts, thinking about the Bible, thinking about other other language and other, you know, other things that were informing what it means for me to be whole and holy, which I believe is womanist theologians. I believe that that's what their intention was to be able mm-hmm. to look into the Bible and say, God has not forgotten me. God has still seen me holy and whole. But what mm-hmm. Dr. Katie Geneva Cannon was doing, a womanist, one of the first white womanist theologians, she was looking at the text and she was saying, oh, there actually is other text that sees us as holy and whole. And we can't just depend on the Bible to affirm us. And so that's where The Color Purple, where Beloved, where, you know, Eve's Bayou, where Lemonade, where these other Black yes. womanist theologians really began to pull from these other places that saw Black women enfleshed as holy and whole and saying, oh, this also is sacred text. While I was raised in the church, I simultaneously, however, was raised by hip hop. Mm-hmm. And so it felt impossible when I really came into a deeper understanding of my own mission, you know, my own vision statement inside of this womanist work. It felt impossible for me to not bring hip hop into that conversation because I would be hearing it was an ethical issue. I would be yes. hearing people critiquing, you know, lyricists, critiquing MCs, critiquing hip hop as this vulgar, violent thing mm-hmm. when Jay-Z and Paul could say the exact same thing. And the question for me was, why is Paul credible and Jay-Z is not? Mm-hmm. Why is First Timothy credible and, you know, Lil Wayne is not? Mm-hmm. And even Dr. Kashima Hutchison does this with from a sociological perspective. Why is Maslow credible and Meek Mill is not? And so it's really just kind of this ethical conversation of mm-hmm. if this person is saying the exact same thing as this person who has lived this experience and is talking mm-hmm. about their lived experience, then it really does come down to ethics. You're excluding this for a reason. Yes. And we don't need to really, you know, search hard to figure out why you're excluding hip hop from the conversation.
Yeah, I feel like I have an idea of why that's happening.
I feel like I have an idea why, you know, why Esther is esteemed and Cardi B is not. Why, right? Like I don't think it's hard for us to get to that understanding, but it just didn't feel like I could talk about the text and the language and the, you know, the realities that made me this whole free version of myself without hip hop, because hip hop is the language of my, you know, identity in so many ways.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a couple questions about the chapters of your book.
Okay.
Or maybe I'll combine it.
Okay.
All right. What was the easiest chapter to write and why? What was the hardest chapter to write and why?
Okay.
And what chapter were you proudest of how it came out?
Okay. The easiest chapter to write was probably In Pursuit of Unashamedness, okay. actually, because I wrote that chapter like 12 years ago, honestly. Because once you read the book, there's a letter that I wrote to my elders. I wanted to talk about sex, and mm-hmm. I still identified as a Christian at the time, but I was in a theological shift, and yeah. I needed to talk about my body, and I needed to talk about, you know, being a single woman with no children, you know, who was mm-hmm. largely mostly celibate, and that, you know, there was no one in my family that had lit that at that point had lived to that age. I'm in my 30s at that point, right? That had lived mm-hmm. to this age as a single celibate, you know, saved woman, right? And so mm-hmm. I started writing that chapter years ago. Okay. So when it was time for me to write it for this book and really, really put it in this book, it was easier for me to just kind of roll it out. In fact, there's a first version of it where I was still going to be watered down. And mm-hmm. there's the version of it where I like pulled the Band-Aid and off. And I feel like the chapter starts off with me talking about sucking dick. So ain't no telling. Like, let me just rip the Band-Aid off. We're about to talk about sex.
Yeah, I hope you don't like small talk, ladies and gentlemen, because we're skipping.
Yikes. So that was probably the easiest chapter. The hardest chapter to write was probably the chapter In Pursuit of My Ancestors, because even though my theological shift is full, and I don't know that anybody's mm-hmm. confused about that, I'm from a family of ministers, right? Like super deeply mm-hmm. Christian, you know, deeply, deeply Christian. And so yeah. For me to talk about ancestors, I felt like, and I know my target audience is, I know my target audience is Black women who are largely Christian or Christian adjacent. So talking about venerating ancestors could get a little touchy, right? Because of, you know, what the term I coined, the Christian demonic filter. The Christian demonic filter, when Black people start talking about our ancestors or venerating ancestors, it's automatically like, this is demonic. I don't want to talk about this. I'm going to skip this whole chapter. And so that was tough for me because I knew that my aunts, my mom, you know, my Sunday school teachers are going to potentially read this book and have to deal with this about me. And then additionally, it felt like there was such a huge responsibility to make sure that my readers didn't miss what was very important about this chapter because the Christian demonic filter was keeping them from being able to be in relationship with that material. Mm-hmm. And the chapter that I love the most actually is In Pursuit of Softness, because I just think it's a really good story inside that chapter. And softness has been such a major goal for me because I used to be like a super thug, like keep your heart, three stacks, keep your heart. These girls are smart. Play your part. That was me. Like, just really, really hardcore guarding my heart. And so softness is like, you know, high goal for me. So writing that chapter and knowing that I have been, you know, enfleshing that reality, I feel really proud of that.
I want to mention that actually, because your people did reach out to me about commenting about softness. And since I was not able to meet that deadline, I think I'd like to actually just kind of share something with you that's a bit vulnerable about that space, right? Mm-hmm. As a male person, I'm cautious, you know, when people are like, Andre seems nice. People respect him. Let's have him be an example in some way, right? And part of that, I think, is so when I got the request, I literally called other Black women in my life and said, okay, someone asked me to do this, but the only way for me to do this with any integrity is if it's true, right? Like this was an opportunity for a check-in, right? So do you feel like you are able to be soft with me, you know? Mm-hmm. And luckily everyone I asked said yes, right? Like I felt good about that. And so I didn't know that I could say like how I'm committed to doing that, because I think that I think about this in terms that are so natural, because I don't think in terms of like, you know what I think you might understand where I'm going with this. There are people who have the very strong boxes, the gender boxes, right? Like, men are supposed to be this way. Women are supposed to be this way. And so they don't allow it, right? And I think that I just look at the people in my life, the women in my life, as full people, right? So they need to be able to be themselves around me. As I say this now, I think another thing that challenges me is I remember the times in my life, even feeling like I'm not, even feeling like if I, even feeling like I'm one of the good guys, quote unquote, right? That I have not been very nurturing to the women around me, right? And they might be small, but there's still at least microaggressions, right? Like I'm thinking of a time where a woman I was dating and I were crossing the street, right? And I'm like ahead of her and she's like a couple steps behind her. And I had this attitude like, keep up, you know what I mean? So like for that reason, I'm like, that's why I'm a bit, and I know like that was years ago and I have it in my head now, like I wouldn't do that kind of thing now, but that's partly why I'm shy about that. So I say this to you in person on my podcast, somewhat publicly, also because I feel like more people who talk about social justice need to be open about their mistakes, you know?
We can say mistakes, but really just our growth and our evolution.
Like,
let's just keep it real.
Yes.
I grew up in a Southern Black Christian experience.
Yeah.
So if you think for 1 minute that there is no period of my life where I was homophobic, that's silly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's silly.
Yeah.
Like the circumstances of my upbringing. Now, does that excuse my behavior in that time period? Absolutely not. But I'm never worried about getting canceled about that period of my life because I'm going to tell you the truth. Yes, right. I was. And right. at which point I did what Dr. Brittany Cooper talks about, you know, evolving our grown woman theology. Mm. Once I actually got into my own grown woman theology and thought about it, I was like, wait a minute. I don't know if this is really what I believe. I just been so deeply socialized into this yes. response. Right. Yes. And so I want to offer deep grace both to you, to myself, to others about yeah. what this journey looks like is that yeah. we have made some major missteps, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
our culture, our, you know, society, like so much of that has created that. And at which point you know better,
right.
did you start to do better?
Right.
That is
exactly.
the gauge mm. of whether or not we can, you know, feel safe with one another is that when you were called in to that moment or when you mm-hmm. finally got that revelation, did you change your behavior? Yes, right. drastically, right? Yeah. Yes, yeah. drastically. And there are still, because what James Baldwin, the house is on fire, we all have inhaled the smoke, right? There mm-hmm. are still moments when I'm over here, yeah. you know, scratching and surviving and hanging in a child line trying to figure out how to have good integrity and, you know, good character. Yeah. And when I catch myself, which is the work, that's a part of my work, that yeah. also is a part of my activism. When I catch myself, I'm like, oh, Ebony Janice, still a mess.
Yeah.
Yeah. <a mess.
laughs> yeah. 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 We all have our growing edges. So, you know, mm-hmm. I appreciate being able to share that with you and I appreciate what mm-hmm. you shared about that. I do feel like, you know, the culture that we have in social justice, social media land, mm-hmm. needs more of us being able to say like these have been my growing edges and stuff
yeah,
like that. So
let's keep
I feel
it
like,
real, guys.
Yeah, let's keep it all the way real. Well, we are running short on time, so
I have one more question.
Go ahead, Trish.
I wanted to ask, kind of going back to what you were saying about the spiritual aspects of mm-hmm. womanism, and I was on your Instagram page and I came across this video of you talking about manifestation.
Okay.
And I was really curious because I, in my personal life, I am saying my affirmations, doing my meditation, manifesting, but I've always felt this conflict. Mm-hmm. about having that sort of belief system and then also the way that those sort of like new age spiritualism and manifesting has been taken by whiteness as a way mm-hmm. to blame the oppressed for their own oppression.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on how do you reconcile both of those things?
Mm-hmm.
Because I always feel like they're almost like two different identities.
Yeah, I don't at all. I feel like, okay, so I started this conversation before we started recording saying that I'm a Capricorn. So keep in mind, I love a strategy. I love, you know, I love step one, step two, step three. And so that has certainly been a part of my life. But even that isn't arbitrary to this conversation about spirituality, because I believe that part of the reason that the stars aligned in such a way that this is the path that I was supposed to be on. Also, mm. I am an initiated Ifa priestess, and Ifa has this saying, it's Ohun Ori Wase Ko Manis Ale Seio, which means what Ori came to fulfill, it can't but fulfill it. Mm. Ori is your head, it's your path, it's your destiny. And so I'm on a path. I just feel like, you yeah. know, they're like, this is my destiny, that there is something that will move on my behalf to ensure that I get to where it is that I'm supposed to go. And I don't use the language of spirituality or manifestation or religion or any of it to blame other people for not being where it is that I am on my path, because this is my path. Mm-hmm. This is like there is a version of me and maybe possibly another lifetime that would hate this life, that mm-hmm. would be like, I hate. You know, having to talk about black stuff. I hate, you know, I don't even want to be a girl, right? Like that would hate this. Yeah. And also, but in this lifetime, in this timeline, this is my path. And so if you have come to the place where you're in pursuit of just something sweeter, something softer, something greater for yourself, I believe that that's a part of your path. That's a part of your destiny to desire it and to do whatever it is spiritually and or in the natural world to make it be so. And if it is not so, it's not because you're a failed human being. It's because this is your path, what Ori came to fulfill. It cannot but fulfill it.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for being here. We like thank to close you. The episodes with asking this question of okay. What keeps you going?
A romance novels, love. That's it, for real. Black love. I'm just always thinking about love, how to make it, how to be it, how to have it, how to cultivate it, you know. And so romance novels have been a major tool for me to stay in the sweetness and also, you know, a little bit of smut every now and then is healing. That's the benediction.
Oh my God. Well, Ebony Janice, it's been such a pleasure having this conversation with you. Thank you to all our listeners for listening to this episode of the Hope and Heart Pills podcast. Again, as always, we appreciate you. I totally forgot to say this at the beginning, but our podcast is brought to you by our generous patrons at Patreon in part. Thank you all. Thank you all our patrons for the dollars that help make this show happen. No matter where you are and what you're going through and what's happening in the world, I want you to remember that a new world is possible. It does not have to be this way because we are tomorrow makers, and you will hear from us next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for choosing to listen today. You can catch up with our hosts online. Trish's is at Trish's Music. That's spelled T-R-I-S-H-E-S Music on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. Andre is at The Andre Henry on Instagram and TikTok, and at Andre Henry on Twitter. Catch the songs you heard today and more of their music on Spotify. If you'd like to support what we're doing here and see the video of Andre and Trisha's conversation, you can join the Patreon at www.patreon.com/AndreHenry. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.